Thank you very much, Tim, and thank you all for coming. It's a great pleasure to have Sir John Major with us this afternoon. We have tried but never had a former Prime Minister come to the Chalk Valley before, but now that there are quite so many, we're hoping that it could become a regular slot. We're just in discussions to find the right size tent for all of Liz Truss's supporters. Sir John, this is a history festival. We're going to talk quite a bit about politics, but let's begin with the history. You have met an awful lot of figures who were major political figures, now historic figures. Is there one that you could single out that your impression of them is different to ours and different to the contemporary historical impression of?
Well, I could probably offer you about 100 who are certainly different. But if I can pick out some of the more extraordinary figures, I might perhaps start with Boris Yeltsin. I'm very fond of Boris because, for one thing, he produced the best one-liner I've ever heard. I was walking with him in the Kremlin, and I turned around and I suddenly said to him, "Tell me, Boris, in one word, what is the state of Russia?" He said, "Good." I was surprised it was falling to pieces. I said, "Tell me in two words." He said, "Not good." After we had both left office, I bumped into Boris in a dinner party in London, and we sat opposite one another, and he said to me, "What are you doing?" I said, "Well, as it happens, Boris, tomorrow I'm going to Moscow." "You're going to Moscow tomorrow," he said. "So am I. Come in my plane." I said, "You've got a plane?" He said, "Yes." He said, "Putin gave me a plane," which Blair didn't do for me. We got in the plane. It was Heathrow, so it was stranded on the tarmac for some time. And I got there at 8 o'clock in the morning, and his plane was a 747. And the only people in it were Boris, his team, my wife, myself, my chief of staff, and my team. And we sat down to have some breakfast. And a waiter appeared in full waiter's outfit, full fig, including white gloves. And he brought us both a huge vodka at 8 o'clock in the morning. And I said, "Come on, Boris, what's this? It's 8 o'clock. He said, "Well," he said, "it's an old Russian custom. You have to toast a successful takeoff." So we toasted a successful takeoff, and you know what? It worked. We were flying, eventually, in the middle of breakfast, and up comes the waiter again with another tray and another large vodka. I said, "Come on, Boris, we've toasted to takeoff. What's this?" "Ah," he said, "it's an old Russian custom. We have to toast a successful landing." So we did that. A little later, he came up again with a third large vodka. I said, "Come off it, Boris. We've toasted to takeoff. We've toasted to landing. What's this?" And he looked at me with soulful eyes, and he said, "How long have you known me, John? Would you begrudge me one little drink?" So he was very unlike his public persona. Another one in a quite different way was actually George H.W. Bush, the elder Bush, the first Gulf War Bush, who was, to all intents and purposes, a rather patrician, rather shy person who many people thought might have strayed into politics by mistake. That was a very bad misjudgment. He was also one of the most competitive men I ever met. And if I may say so, I think one of the nicest men in politics, nicest, most genuine men in politics that I ever met over a very long period. And Norma and I used to stay with he and Barbara at Maine, at Kennebunkport. And he used to take us off to dinner in his old boat. He called it a cigarette boat for some reason. And he was followed by his Secret Service detail. And his great joy was to ride the boat at such speed that he left the Secret Service detail behind. So he went bouncing along on the waves, and I was clinging on desperately in this open boat, saying, "Do you not think you ought to slow down a little?" And he said no and went a little faster. And I said, "What about your Secret Service detail? They've been left behind." "Ah," he said, "they had been left behind, and they will report that. And as a result of that, they will get a bigger, better, and faster boat, and we can have more fun next time." So he too, much misunderstood man.
Well, you've mentioned two men that I'd like to ask you about. First, your relationship with George H.W. Bush was really cemented over the first Gulf War. And I wanted to ask you about the decision not to go all the way to Baghdad and not to topple Saddam Hussein in 1991. Why was that?
Because we thought it would be foolish to go into Iraq, because if we went into Iraq and toppled Baghdad, we would have owned the country and we would have had to run it. And we foresaw all sorts of difficulties. Were anyone ever likely to do that?
Can't think who you're thinking of.
We thought of dangerous insurrections. And the other point that was very crucial to us was, don't enter into something like that until you know how you're going to get out of it. You need an exit strategy. And that, I think, is particularly true when you're dealing with military matters, such as the invasion of Kuwait by the Iraqis. We knew our exit strategy. We were there to evict the Iraqis from Kuwait. And if you recall, George Bush formed the most remarkable coalition of nations that were drawn together at any time since the Second World War. And he did that, firstly, because he was a supreme diplomat, and secondly, because they were aware from the United Nations resolution that our job was to evict the Iraqis from Kuwait, not to go into Kuwait and run a Gulf state. And had we tried to do that, apart from the fact it was never in our mind, it would have broken the coalition apart. And we would have found ourselves in very great difficulty. So there were a range of things. And we discussed all those long before the starting date. I'd only been prime minister a fortnight. Oh, and by the way, Tim, that 15% interest rates I inherited from Nigel Lawson and Margaret Thatcher, they weren't mine. I mentioned that merely in passing, since this is a history occasion. I went out to see George Bush, and we discussed then when the Gulf War would start and how it would conclude. We were much more worried about it than in the event it turned out to be necessary. The great fear among the troops, I went out to speak to the troops 5 days before war started. I actually went out to tell the commanding officer, Peter de Lavilliers, when it would start, the 16th of January. And I remember standing on a tank speaking to an audience of this size and a good deal more of young men who were going to war for the first time. And the operative word is young. I looked at them, they were between, I would guess, 17 and 25, the vast bulk of them. And as it happened, the day the war was scheduled to begin was my son's 16th birthday. And I looked at this vast crowd of young men and a few young women as well, and I superimposed automatically my son's face upon their faces when I was talking to them. And it's a moment I've never forgotten. Old men and old women send people to war, but it's young men and young women who get killed in the war. And I was very conscious of that, made even more so by that single particular meeting. But we had traded, marked out exactly what we thought would happen with the war at a meeting with George Bush at Camp David a fortnight earlier, a month earlier.
Your experience as Prime Minister in that sense was invaluable, and you had gone and decided with George Bush Senior that you were not going to go all the way to Baghdad. When, fast forward 10 years, did Tony Blair call you and say, how does this work? Is this a good idea?
I think the phones were down. the answer to that is no.
It's quite odd if you think of someone who's done it before.
The then leader of the... Well, that's not a question for me. The then leader of the Conservative Party had already offered the total support of the Conservative Party for whatever the government wished to do in the Second Gulf War. I don't know upon what basis he formed that judgment, but he did.
Turning to a different element of foreign affairs, one part of the narrative that has been developed about the war in Ukraine at the moment is that the Western powers did not do enough to bring the Yeltsin Russia into the fold, and that Putin and these other people who went through the trauma of seeing the decline and fall of the Soviet Union had a lasting resentment which we are now reaping the rewards of. You were Prime Minister at the time of the fall of the Soviet Union. Do you think the West did enough to bring Russia into the liberal democratic mainstream?
There were very different views among the Western countries. The UK actually wished to do more. But we didn't prevail at a G7 meeting in, I think, 91 or 92. We didn't prevail. Other nations didn't wish to offer a great deal more help. And they didn't want to do it because they saw a Russia in chaos, likely to get in greater chaos, and they thought any help we gave would actually be money wasted. They had some sound reasons for not doing it. We British wished to offer a little more help, but we were outvoted and outgunned at the G7, and we weren't able to do so. I've often wondered whether it would have made a difference, whether we would have had someone perhaps a little better than Putin. But Russia in the 1990s really was the Wild West. I mean, Yeltsin faced great difficulty. The point about Yeltsin and Gorbachev before them, both of them, they both wished to be part of the free market. And when you talk to them, they did not understand what the free market was. They thought the free market was a few private sector spivs doing what the state would do. That was actually, I mean, that's perhaps a slightly unfair way of putting it, but they did not understand the intricacies of the free market. They did not understand the intricacies of share ownership, that you can buy a few shares and you own a small portion of a large company. All that was quite alien to Russian history and to Russian current practice at the time. And so when they tried to move towards a Western system, they did so without the backing or the knowledge to actually do it properly, and at a time of huge turmoil. And of course, the Russian experience of the free market in the 1990s was very bad, which is one reason, I think, why they're so alien to so much of it now.
Turning from foreign affairs to personal affairs, when was it, you think, that you first thought that you wanted to become Prime Minister?
Well, I didn't, to be absolutely truthful. I first went to the House of Commons when I was 13. And my background perhaps is a bit relevant to that. My father was 65 when I was born. My mother was surprised. And as a Victorian man, he was born in 1879. As a Victorian man, he'd entered into a business arrangement with someone, and it had gone wrong, and he had lost everything he had. I would have been about 10 at the time. He lost our home, all the money he had. And we moved to two rooms in Brixton. And I began to see a very different side of life in Brixton. It was Brixton in the early 50s, a time of mass immigration and a great deal of hardship in the area. And I was always interested in history. I began to take a greater interest in history and politics at that time. And I bumped into the local Labour MP, Colonel Marcus Lipton. And he was an extremely good constituency MP, the sort of member of parliament any constituency would be happy to have. And he could see from the way we talked that I was probably not a Labour supporter. But even so, he saw me as a young man interested in politics, and he gave me two tickets to go to the House of Commons. And I went there on a dull Wednesday afternoon to see the committee stage of the Finance Bill 1956. And Harold Macmillan spoke briefly. But as I walked into the House of Commons, the atmosphere reached out and grabbed me. And I thought to myself, this is where I wish to spend my life. And that feeling never went away, not until the day I left, when I thought the rest of my life I might spend somewhere else. But it is a very compelling place. In every corner there is history. Something happened wherever you look in the House of Commons. It is full of the most remarkable atmosphere and the most remarkable stories. So from that date onwards, I wished to get into Parliament. But my ambition really was to be Chancellor of the Exchequer for a long time, not Prime Minister.
I think you will deny knowledge that Margaret Thatcher was grooming you to be her successor, but it seems that it was very obvious to all of your colleagues. They've all attested to it both at the time and since. Have you ever wondered why she wanted you to be her successor? Because being very serious, there were an awful lot of other members of the cabinet who were more Thatcherite than you, drier than you. Why do you think she chose you?
Well, I don't know, is the simple answer. We began our relationship with a furious row. I was in the whip's office, and the chief whip held a dinner for the prime minister once a year. and we had that dinner, and Margaret was always uncomfortable after small talk. Her small talk lasted about 90 seconds, if that. And then she wished to talk about something serious. And so John Wakeham, who was the chief whip, said, well, all right, Prime Minister, we'll start with Treasury Affairs. I'll ask the Treasury whip to report on what the party think of policy. And I was the Treasury whip. Now, the party's views on the economic policy at the time were not favorable. And I reported exactly what the party thought. And Margaret was outraged. I don't think anybody had told her before how upset and worried and nervous the party was over the economic policy at the time. And she attacked me as the messenger. And I thought, hang on, this is a bit unreasonable. I'm the messenger. And I fought back, making it perfectly clear to her that I wasn't necessarily advancing my views, though they were my views as it happened, but I was advancing the views of the party as a large, as she had asked me to do. And the row went on for some time. Mm-hmm. And one of the whips from the House of Lords, Baroness Trumpington, interesting name, that I once asked her why she was Baroness Trumpington. She said, well, I had to pick a name when I became a peer, and there were two villagers. One was Trumpington, and the other was something quite unspeakable. So that's why it became Trumpington. And poor her, she got her head bitten off. Then Carol Mather intervened. Carol Mather was not a lady, it was a man. He'd been Montgomery's ADC in the war. Very brave man. And she bit his head off too and returned to me, and the row continued. At the end of the meeting, sitting at the back had been a number of people, one of whom was Margaret's husband. Dennis came over, clapped me on the shoulder and said, she'll have enjoyed that, don't worry about it. While the other whip said to me, well, that's the end of your career, you can come back when she isn't Prime Minister. And the very next day, I was sitting on the Treasury bench, the front bench, as the whip on duty. And Margaret came in from the Prime Minister's office behind the Speaker's chair, sat down beside me and said, I've been thinking about our conversation last night. I think we better start again and talk about it once again, and we did. And 5 weeks later, she put me in her government.
I wanted to ask, do you think that your political philosophy developed much once you became Prime Minister, or was it quite set in stone? Because once you were Prime Minister, I don't think it's no secret if you read your memoirs or see any of the other speeches you've given that you did not have a harmonious relationship with your predecessor as Prime Minister. To what extent had she misjudged you? She thought you were one of us and you were actually one of you. And to what extent were you finding a new realm as Prime Minister of political philosophy?
It wasn't that at all. You're quite right. Our relationship deteriorated badly. And there were three reasons for that, really. The first was that what drove Margaret out of office was not Europe. This is the common fallacy put about. But it wasn't. It was the poll tax that really lost her support in the parliamentary party. The poll tax went badly wrong. It was a local government tax. It was going to charge everyone. The Duke and the Dustman would have paid exactly the same. And the figures were horrendous. And that was a policy she had been encouraged to adopt, and she adopted it, and she stuck by it. And it was plainly unavoidable. It had to go. So the first thing I did as Prime Minister was abolish a policy that she had strongly supported. The second thing I did, which upset her deeply, was bring Michael Heseltine back into the cabinet. And that, too, was unavoidable. Michael had come second in the election for leader. He was also a remarkable and, in many ways, quite unique talent at the time. To have had a Conservative candidate without Michael Heseltine would have been foolish. So those were two things. From her point of view, she suddenly saw me take her job and do two things immediately, both of which were anathema to her. And she was then surrounded by a lot of friends who were only too keen to say to her, well, you should still be Prime Minister. This chap's only been in Parliament 11 years, and pile on grievances. And I think it was a combination of those three things. It was never personal in the sense that you might understand it, because she began to be ill, as I think everyone knows around about that time, maybe even a little earlier. And from time to time, I spoke to her, briefed her about what was happening. I took her out to lunch. We talked. I went to her home and we had coffee together. So when we were together, the relationship was entirely amiable. When we were apart, there were enough people stirring the pot to make it difficult. And That is something occasionally you see repeated, you know. It does happen again and again.
Well, I wanted to ask you, having lived through this, and you say in your autobiography that you thought at certain times, should I say something about her supporters and her and all the activities against you during the Maastricht votes that were going on, all of this disloyalty, what would your advice be to a prime minister who has a problem with his predecessor?
It would be, I can't imagine what you're talking about, so I speak purely dispassionately about this. I think it was a difficult situation in the 1990s. It was different, not least because Margaret was ill. And not least, and I hope this is not a silly point to make, but having Victorian parents, I had a very strict upbringing about how you behave towards other people, and particularly how you behave towards women. So I felt a little restricted in publicly responding, though privately we did talk about it, sometimes quite fiercely. But I think the present circumstances are very difficult and very different. I think the damage that was done over the last few years was immense. I think it was immense. It was widespread, it was deep, and it will be used by the Conservative Party's opponents for a long time to come. And the present Prime Minister has to carve out entirely his own route and disassociate himself from many of the things that were done as credibly as he can.
Well, we might come on to current politics again at the end, but to your premiership at the moment, I imagine that if you have been Prime Minister and being a reflective sort of man as you are, you will relive those 7 years and have done many times. Is there one moment you keep going back to in your mind and thinking, if I could change just one thing in my premiership, I would change that one thing, and you know what it is?
Oh, I know exactly what it is, yes. I'd have put the Maastricht Treaty through Parliament before the 1992 election. In the 87 to 92 Parliament, I became Prime Minister in the middle of that Parliament in 1990. There was a massive majority for the negotiation at Maastricht, a massive majority. It was 500 in favor. Tory party almost unanimously with a 10, 12, maybe 15 people unhappy about it. But the whole nature of the Conservative Party changed in 1992. All the last remnants of the wartime and post-wartime senior members left Parliament at that election. And that matters because they fought in the war or were very close to it afterwards. And they believed the most important thing to do in politics was to make sure that we were in lockstep with Europe so that there would never again be a European war. That was sunk deep into their instincts. The young men and women who came in 1992, the 1980s was a much more ideological age, and they came in with a completely different view. So from a parliament in which we had a massive majority for the Maastricht Treaty, when we came back, we had no majority at all. Because I had, although we had, in terms of votes, a massive win in 1992, we had a 7% lead over Labour in votes, which is fairly unprecedented. And we also had more votes cast for the Conservatives in 1992 than ever before or since in history. And yet we were only given, because of the vagaries of the boundaries, a majority of 21 seats, of whom 30 were unreliable on every conceivable European issue. So we were a minority government for Europe throughout the 92 to 97 Parliament, and that changed the Parliament. It changed history, it changed what we could do, it changed everything. And so if there was one thing I would go back and change, it would have been to have put the Maastricht Bill through before the 92 election. But it was very difficult because there wasn't really a chance. I could either have had the Maastricht Treaty through or finish other bits of legislation. And since the majority for Maastricht was so huge, I didn't foresee the difficulty we would have in the next Parliament.
Maastricht and the issue of Europe bedeviled your premiership to a large extent, and you had a huge amount of infighting within the Conservative Party. There's been a suggestion since, and maybe it was put to you at the time, that you should have been more ruthless. Do you think you should have been more ruthless? Should you have sacked the people you were caught describing as bastards from your cabinet?
I thought about it a lot. But the difficulty was the size of the split in the Conservative Party and the lack of a majority on all European matters made that a very difficult circumstance. If I'd had the majority of 60 or 70, which we would normally have had on the number of votes cast, I would certainly have acted in that fashion, but I didn't have that majority. And you have to deal with the parliament you've got. It seemed to me, because of the differences over Europe, from the moment I became prime minister, I had one foot either side of a widening gulf in the ground between the two wings of the Conservative Party. And I didn't wish to turn the screws so tightly that I broke the Conservative Party into pieces. That was not what I wished to do. Many of the things I would have wished to do in the 92 to 97 Parliament, I couldn't do. Firstly, because we were trying to correct the recession. I mean, Tim talked about interest rates, and it's perfectly true. The interest rates, well, they were actually 14% on the day I became Prime Minister, not 15%. But at the same time, inflation was 9.8, going up to beyond 10. Interest rates were 14%. We were heading for a recession, and we had a massive fiscal difference. Now, when I was a boy, if you've ever lived in a household where the week lasts longer than the money, you understand and fear the impact of inflation, which many people are doing at the present time and seeing it very vividly. Government after government for 30 years had tried to get inflation down. None had. It had temporarily receded and come back. And that was why I joined the exchange rate mechanism, because it was a system that would stop us being able to act unilaterally for our own party political convenience in giving up the battle against inflation. And although we were thrown out of it ignominiously, which was a political disaster but not an economic disaster, because when we were thrown out, we were looking at how we could leave without difficulties, it had done its work. And we had since then 30 years of low inflation. That wasn't only because of what we did. The world changed in the late 90s to a lower inflation environment, but we weren't to know it would do that. But whereas inflation was the dominant issue for 30 years, that period in the 1990s when we were there broke the inflationary spiral. But to do it, we had to do some very unpopular things. High interest rates, high taxes, and getting them down were very difficult indeed. And after 18 years in government, people understandably wanted a new beginning. And so we handed over an exchequer that was balanced, an economy that was growing at 3.5%. With productivity at that time four times higher than the current rates of productivity in the British economy. So it was a pretty good inheritance for our successors.
You're not part of the anti-growth coalition then?
No, absolutely not. I mean, one thing I think that Liz Truss got right is that we need policies for growth, but there have to be policies for growth that work, not policies for growth that break up the economy into little pieces and wreck our fiscal standing at home and our international fiscal propriety abroad. Apart from that, she was okay.
Well, one could say that you had some experience of this. She had her Black Wednesday extended over a number of days. Yours was on one day. In retrospect, do you have regrets about the exchange rate mechanism? Should we have gone in at a different rate? And purely in retrospect, do you think you should have agreed with Norman Lamont and got out of it earlier in the day on the actual
day? Well, let me take
itself.
Those points one by one. Did we go in at the wrong rate? Well, let's consider the options. We could have gone in at a higher rate, which would have been more damaging, which Margaret wanted us to do as a disinflationary point. Not something often remarked of these days, but she did. She wanted to go in at 3 Deutschmarks, not 2.95. We could have gone in at 2.95, which was the market rate, or we could have gone in at 2.90, which would effectively have been weakening our anti-inflation strategy. Now, what would you have done? You'd have gone in at 2.95, and so did I. And so did every sensible person at the time. It was only with the benefit of that glorious advantage of hindsight that people actually suggested the alternative. On the day, could we have left earlier? Conceivably. But what merit would we have had across the world if we'd entered into an agreement with all our European partners and then run away without testing whether we could actually have remained in the exchange rate mechanism and left in good order? I think that would have been a cheap thing to do. I can see why it was proposed, but I think it was very difficult to do. As soon as it was clear that we couldn't turn the tide, we pulled out. But until then, there was a possibility we could. We put interest rates up for an afternoon to 15%, and we took them straight down again the next following morning, back down to the, I think, 10% they were at the time. So they went up in a spike and went down the next day, simply trying to protect the exchange rate of sterling, but we couldn't. But what is interesting, if you go a few months later, when the economy had settled down, the exchange rate had gone exactly back to where we were before we left the exchange rate mechanism. So we had guessed correctly. And these people who don their anti-European hats and claim it could all have been done in a different way have never actually indicated to me in any sensible measure what they might have done as an alternative and whether that alternative would actually have killed inflation, which is what we managed to do. So no, I'm not repentant about that. I'm sorry about the way in which it hurt people. I'm sorry about the way in which it hurt the Conservative Party. But our job, I don't wish to be pious about this, but our job was to do what was right for the country in the medium and long term, and I'm convinced we did.
Returning to Europe and Maastricht, Britain, under your leadership, did not have a referendum on Maastricht. The Dutch and the French did. You have spoken a lot recently about the importance of parliamentary sovereignty and the nature of a parliamentary democracy. Do you think it was a mistake to have had a referendum to decide something so massive as Britain's membership of the European Union in 2016?
Well, I can tell you what I thought about Maastricht. There was pressure for a referendum on Maastricht. But the trouble is, a referendum is never just about the subject that you put before the public. If you look at the referendum on the European Union, the one we lost in 2016, I was inundated with letters afterwards from people saying, I didn't really want us to leave, but I was really fed up with the government and I wanted to give them a good kicking, and I didn't think there was any chance we'd lose the referendum. And how many people voted in the referendum? We're told repeatedly 52% of the people voted to leave. No, they jolly well didn't. 37% voted to leave, and 35% voted to stay, and the others didn't vote. If they had felt strongly about it, strongly about the present situation as it then was in Europe, they probably would have turned out to vote. So I'm very dubious about whether there really was a genuine majority in the country as a whole if everyone had voted to leave. And certainly, I don't know how you disaggregate those people who voted against the government to give it a kicking in 2016 and where we would have been. I do know it was a disreputable campaign from start to finish, and everybody has something to regret in it, but I think some people more than others. And many of the things that were categorized as project fear have, I'm afraid, to the great detriment of this country, become project reality right now. So I'm not in favor of referenda.
Where do you see the future of Britain's relationship with Europe? Do you think in the next 20 years it's conceivable that Britain would rejoin either the single market or the European Union?
Well, I think no one can be certain. I mean, let's take rejoining the European Union as a whole first. As of now, I can't tell you what the European Union will be like in 20 years' time. It seems to me highly likely Ukraine will join, Moldova will join, and others will join, and that is going to change the nature of the European Union and perhaps change it quite substantially. The second point is, having left the European Union with the particular advantages, the rebate that Margaret Thatcher got, the ability I gained at Maastricht for us not to join the euro and not to be part of what I described as a job-destroying social chapter, those would not be advantages we would get next time. So we would be joining with different advantages in a different European Union, and you cannot be certain what it would be like in 20 years' time. Now, we could rejoin, because young people, and from my perception, that's under 45 these days, younger people were overwhelmingly in favor of the European Union. And as we older folk disappear from the scene, they will be running the country and they may make a decision to join. So it is certainly possible. It may be the show is not over yet. The second point is, should we get closer to them economically? And the answer to that is absolutely, undoubtedly, yes. With the exception of a handful of economists, and it really is a handful, there is not a serious economist that does not believe our economy has been seriously and negatively impacted by leaving the European Union. The estimates are that our economy suffers by something up to 1% a year, which may not sound much, but it's a lot of hospitals and schools and pay demands. But people average at about 4%. They think we've lost about 4% of GDP. That is a massive loss. And I'll give you another couple of illustrations. One in three small businesses that did trade with Europe no longer trade with Europe because of the impediments put in their way to do so by bureaucracy of one sort or another, because we are outside the European Union. And frankly, the damage it has done to us politically and reputationally around the world is severe. Most of the world thinks they cannot understand why we should possibly have taken ourselves out of the European Union. And I'll give you one illustration of that. We've always been very proud in our country that we punch above our weight in the world, and we do. And yet we are 70 million people in a world of 8,000 million. That's a pretty small percentage. But we punched heavily, partly because of history, partly because of language, but also for a number of other reasons as well. When people looked at Britain and they saw her as a leading member of the European Union, they thought we were speaking for 500 million people, not 70 million people. When they looked at our closeness to the United States, they thought it was highly likely that anything we said was backed also by the United States. That magnified to a dramatic extent the overseas influence that Great Britain had. We have now lost that. America is moving away, not least because we can no longer help America from inside the European Union because we've left it. They now look to Germany to do that. So to a certain extent, although America is still good allies and friends, we have lost a great deal of the influence from them, and we have lost the influence from Europe. And the whole world sees that. And that makes their perception of Britain, their willingness to invest in Britain, and all the other things that have happened in the last few years, negatively impact upon our reputation throughout the whole of the world. It's much bigger than simply losing cash. That's serious enough because of the impact on our standard of life in this country, and will continue to be for a long time, but it's also because of our influence in every single part of the world.
Linking this to history and broadening it beyond Europe, to what extent do you think that the European problem, and indeed Britain's wider problems, are to do with a lack of reckoning with our own history? That in your childhood, Britain still had an empire, just, and we no longer have an empire, but we still have, even most people in this tent will not remember Britain having an empire, but we still have a great nostalgia for our empire, we still have a nostalgia for fighting alone in 1940, and these are events which happened 80 years ago, but are possibly developing the psychological conditions that allow for a sort of siege mentality or glorious isolation. Do you think that we need to have a reckoning with our history?
Well, I think in the interests of the next generation, we should, because we spend too much time looking back at things that were and not things that are and things that will be. We need to look at where we are in the world today. We are an upper middle ranking power. We are not a superpower. We are not China, we are not America, we are not the European Union. We're none of those. But we are an important nation in the second tier of power, and we need to recognize that's where we stand and build on that for the future. Looking back to when we have an empire will do us no good at all. It is history. So much of it we can be very proud, of little bits we can't be so proud. But we need to look forward. We have many great assets in this country, but to believe that we are an exception in everything, that we are the best in everything, plainly is not true. And the fact, if we continue in a mindset that is that way, we will not realize the opportunities that we miss. The point is, being 70 million people in a world of 8,000 million, we need allies and friends. That is why I go back to Europe. We have just left the richest free market the world has ever seen. What sense is there in that if you want to influence people? The government, the Brexiteers were saying, well, we're global Britain now. We're global Britain now. For God's sake, we've been global Britain since the 16th century. What do they think Walter Raleigh was doing when he went around the world? What do they think Drake was doing? Of course, we've been a global power for a long, long time. It's nothing new. But if you're a global power, don't insult your friends with megaphone diplomacy, and don't cut yourself off from some of the richest friends we have in the world who are also our next-door neighbours.
I suppose the trouble is, and I know you don't want to talk about this man, but Boris Johnson did win a referendum and he did win an awful lot of votes in 2019. And one of the reasons, there are lots of reasons for this, but one of the reasons is that people liked a sense of optimism about Britain being great, and they liked, rightly or wrongly, a sense of Britain being great in comparison to others. People quite liked it, even when David Cameron, and I dare say you, went off and gave Johnny Foreigner a good kicking in Brussels. How do we make the argument that you're making, how can it be compelling when you compare it to the populist sort of sugar rush of Britain is great and we'll just punch on through?
Well, look where it's led us now then. We just had 3 or 4 years of populism. I think our present Prime Minister, thank God, is moving away from it. But what has populism done for us now? It's lost us a reputation in every part of the world. It's led us down an economic cul-de-sac. It's lost us our reputation for honesty and decency. It's lost the Conservative Party the advantage it also had that it always accepted the law and never broke the law. Would you like me to go on? I can go on for another 10 or 15 minutes pointing out the difficulties that there are. And let me talk about Boris Johnson as an election winner, a vote winner in the last general election. Now, that is interesting. That is really interesting. In the 2019 general election, Boris did quite well. He got 300,000 more votes than Theresa May did. And the reason we had a majority of 90 was that Jeremy Corbyn got 2,600,000 votes fewer for Labour than he had in the preceding election. This was not so much a Boris Johnson election win as a Jeremy Corbyn election defeat. Now, Boris would have won the election with that, but he wouldn't have won it with a massive majority of the sort comparable before. And our election system is actually quite potty. My majority of 21 in 1992 was after getting pretty nearly 500,000 more votes than Margaret's majority of over 100 5 years earlier. Or indeed 500,000 more votes than Tony Blair got with a majority of 160 5 years later. It is an odd way, the way our election system works at present. But in terms of that election in 2019, Boris Johnson did perfectly credibly as the party leader in winning that election. But the reason for the massive majority was the total collapse of the Labour Party vote.
Taking populism away from Britain for a moment.
Please.
Does Donald Trump frighten you?
Well, I wouldn't say he frightens me, but I wouldn't regard myself as a supporter.
Would you care to elaborate?
No.
Because it could be said, you're here, I believe you celebrated a significant birthday recently, but the President...
Now, that really is unkind.
Well, it was in the newspapers. The President of the United States...
Don't believe everything you read in the newspapers, too. That's a piece of advice I can give you with absolute certainty.
Well, the current President of the United States has celebrated a few more birthdays than you had. Do you think that you maybe hung up your boots a bit young?
No, I don't. I mean, I left the House of Commons when I was 54, I think, something like that. Politics had been my life pretty much all my life until then. And there is a life outside politics. There are books I haven't read, cricket I didn't see, rugby I haven't watched, theatre I don't know about, places I haven't visited, and a million other things to do. I had enormously enjoyed almost all of my time in politics. But there comes a time when you think there are other things in life as well. So I decided not to go to the House of Lords. I did not, have not, and will not go to the House of Lords. It's a bit crowded now anyway. And I'm much too old. You need to be 29. And I thought there was just so much more to do outside politics. So I don't regret leaving now.
Final question before we open it to the floor. You fought two general elections which had very different results. Mm-hmm. Both elections you were expected by the pundits to lose. The first one you won, the second one you lost heavily. We are coming up to a general election again. Everyone expects the Conservatives to lose it, but it has been done before, but the circumstances were different. How comparable is 1992 to 2023 for Rishi Sunak and the Conservatives, or is it fairly inevitable that it's going to be a 1997-style wipeout?
No, that isn't inevitable at all. I mean, there are some similarities between 92 and now, but there are a lot of dissimilarities as well. So I'm not going to predict the next general election. I think they can be very uncertain things. You don't know how the third party vote will turn out. You don't know where it will turn out. We don't know what will happen. If inflation starts to come down with a bump, people might decide, well, they may have got a lot of things that didn't go right, but it's now going right. We'd better stick with the people who are now getting it down. It's impossible to make a judgment as to what will happen at the next general elections. So there are some similarities. But I do think there are two points. I don't think the focus of the government should be simply upon the next general election. I think they will actually do better at the next general election if their focus is more on what is right for the country in the future than what is actually right in terms of headlines and stories for a week or a fortnight or 3 weeks. If they can be perceived as doing what is right for the country, I think they will end up getting a better result, and I don't know what it will be, and I'm not going to predict it. In October of next year, possibly, maybe a bit later, but I would think most probably October of next year, if they actually can be seen clearly and unmistakably to be acting in what they conceive to be the national interest of getting the economy back on an even keel, so this misery we've had over recent months and recent years can be put behind us. And it can. It will change. We can get out of this. It's just that there's no single silver bullet. If anyone comes along and tells you, I've got a policy and it's going to end it all tomorrow, don't trust them and don't vote for them, because that's populism, it's awful and it won't work.
Let's, on that note, open questions to the floor. There are roving microphones, but if you put your hand up, they will find you. And yes, at the back, yes.
Oh, we've missed you. We've missed the soapbox. Well done, lovely to see you again. Your legacy in Northern Ireland hasn't been fully appreciated. If you could wave the wand, if you had the three wishes, what would you see, what would you wish for the future of Ulster?
One of the great disappointments of politics for me was that I wasn't able to finish the Northern Ireland peace process. We'd got a long way towards it, but we couldn't finish it. And the IRA, with its long-standing hostility to a Conservative government and disputes with it, were not very keen on reaching a settlement with us. Fortunately, I was very lucky. Tony Blair came in. He followed on exactly where I left, and he produced the best agreement, I think, that could have been obtained at the time. So I'm delighted that he's done that, and I'm happy to pay tribute to him for doing it. I do think this nonsense we've had over the Northern Ireland Protocol is really nonsense on stilts. I mean, how the government could possibly have thought that first negotiation that was done by Lord Frost and the Prime Minister was satisfactory, I cannot myself imagine. The alternative now produced by the present Prime Minister is much better. But we desperately need to get this matter concluded and get the Democratic Unionists back in politics at Stormont. Without that, the Stormont Parliament is not working, and that is, it is not democracy to have Northern Ireland run by civil servants. So I would certainly wish to have Stormont back. Here in the UK, I do think there are some serious problems that we have to face. When the government started talking about levelling up, I was delighted, because although we may not think it, we have in the United Kingdom some of the poorest parts of anywhere in Europe. And the difference between the well-to-do parts of the UK and the very poor parts of the UK is very wide, and it needs to narrow. And that means that's not something that can be done overnight. It's a policy for 25 years. I'll tell you what my third wish is. My third wish is to have some senior politicians stand up and say to the country what we have to do over the next 25 years to produce a country at ease with itself in the manner that we would wish to see for our children and for our grandchildren. So I think those would be the wishes I would have.
Yes, whoever's got the microphone next. There's a lady here in the middle.
Thank you. I've very recently finished Chris Patten's Hong Kong Diaries. You obviously liked him very much, but more importantly, you thought, and correctly, I believe, the right person for the right job. What are your feelings on what's happening in Hong Kong now?
I'm despairing at what has happened in Hong Kong. I'll tell you how Chris came to be in Hong Kong. In the 92 election, Chris was the Conservative Party chairman. We won the election, but he lost his seat in Bath. And I sat down with him in the White Room at Downing Street the following day. And we thought after four successive election wins, we had probably pulled the democratic elastic as far as it could go. And I said it was a great loss not having Chris in Parliament. And I offered him three alternatives. I said, I will put somebody in the House of Lords and you can fight the by-election and come in the Commons and join the government. That's your first option. The second option, you can go in the Lords and I will put you in the government from the House of Lords. And the third option is you can go and govern Hong Kong. And Chris said, I cannot put my family through another by-election. I'm too young to go to the House of Lords. I will go to Hong Kong. And that is how Chris Patten came to be governor of Hong Kong. A lot of promises were made at the time of the handover in 1997 that have not been kept. And increasingly, it was to be expected that Hong Kong would become a more Chinese city than it had been. But among the promises that were plainly made, and plainly made to me when I spoke to the Chinese as well, was that there would be a free vote after a brief period on who was the chief executive in Hong Kong. And yet, for example, that hasn't happened, and Hong Kong is becoming increasingly progressive, to repressive to anyone who opposes the Chinese government's writ there. And I think that is very regrettable. In due course, it will have a significant impact on Hong Kong as a trading center as well. But for now, it's been a very retrograde step, and I very strongly regret that the Chinese have not kept the promises they made at the time of the handover in 97.
At the back there.
Thank you very much for your kind words. Another great gathering has just finished called Glastonbury, where a whole bunch of middle-aged and somewhat older people have listened to some very elderly rock stars making music again. When are you going to return to politics, please?
I'll probably do it after I've topped the bill at Glastonbury. I will tell you something about one of those rock stars who has been there in the past but isn't there this particular year, Mick Jagger. I knew Mick a bit because we both are very keen on cricket and we bumped into one another. But when for the last 25 years, I've been going around the world almost incessantly. And time and again, we found that the hotel rooms that I traditionally had in a particular part of the world were gone. And nobody would tell us who was in them. And eventually it emerged that every time I was unable to get the rooms I normally had, the Rolling Stones, who booked their rooms even earlier than me, had booked in them and Mick Jagger was in my room. And I met him, of course, when we went out there. I had the disadvantage that he had my room, and the advantage that in recompense for that, he would give me tickets for the Stones show. So I've seen the Rolling Stones perform in many parts of the world and thoroughly enjoyed it. But you're very tempting saying, when can I go back in politics? I'll reflect on it for the next 20 years or so and let you and let you have an answer then.
Gentleman at the front.
Thank you very much, Sir John. How do you think history will judge the current England Test cricket team?
That's a very good question. Well, I think they will judge already that they changed the nature of cricket. Whether they'll judge it as a great team or not, we may find out between now and the end of August. If they beat the Australians over a five-match test series, I think we can truthfully say, given the quality of the present Australian team, which is very high, that history will judge them very kindly indeed. If they were to lose, if they were to draw, the jury would still be out a bit. If they were to lose, I think they would say they've taken brighter cricket a little too casually, but I'm hoping that they will still win. The worry is they have a very bad record at Lords. Do you know how many games they've won against the Australians at Lords in the last century? The answer is 2. So it's not our lucky ground against Australia.
Gentleman in the front.
Sir John, I'm sorry to take you back to politics when we're discussing far more important things like cricket. You spoke very passionately about Europe and about the referendum that we all enjoyed voting in. Why was it that no politician, as far as I'm aware, suggested we had a threshold rather than a simple majority? Wasn't that a failure of all the politicians?
Absolutely. Absolutely it was. And it's astonishing to me that the bill went through the House of Commons and the House of Lords without anyone saying this is a truly a life-changing constitutional matter. There should be a bigger threshold than one vote. And it should be 55% or a certain percentage of the electorate as a whole. As it was, we changed our whole economic future with 37% of the electorate voting to leave the European Union, of which some of them voted for reasons other than Europe. I'm utterly baffled as to why it wasn't. I mean, I talked about it, but obviously nobody was listening. But the fact that it wasn't even considered, nobody even put down an amendment in the Commons or the Lords, absolutely baffles me. And if they're looking ahead to possibly future referendums at some distant time in any part of the United Kingdom, I hope they will bear that in mind when the appropriate legislation is passed.
Gentleman here, and then...
No one's ever asked me that question before. Well done, that's a first.
Sir John, can I ask you to confirm that when Mrs. Barker, the newly minted Lady Trumpington, when you asked her why Trumpington, did she not respond, the alternative village was 6 Mile Bottom, which would you have chosen?
Well, I didn't think that appropriate to say, but you're exactly right. That is exactly what she said. I mean, she was a remarkable character, Jean Trumpington, and I loved her dearly. When we were both in the old Department of Health and Social Security, I think I was Minister for the Disabled, and she was the Parliamentary Secretary in the Lords. There had been a very remarkable and unhappy story in the Daily Mirror, where a minister had obviously been talking about government policy, and the Prime Minister was furious and wanted to know who had said it and had set the Chief Whip on the course to find out who it was. This never works, not least because Chief Whips very rarely really look. But in any event, I was sitting there running through my papers and the phone rang, and on the other end was Jean, and she said, it was me. Do you think I should give the Prime Minister a present? I said, I think she'll have forgotten it by tea time, Jean. Just keep your distance. It was me. She was absolutely lovely, Jean Trumpington.
Gentleman at the very back.
Thank you. So, John, one of the big conversations politically at the moment is migration to the UK and Britain. What would you do if you were Prime Minister today about migration, and what would you think would be best for the country?
Ah, well, there's some interesting contradictions here with migration. Since about 2.5 million of the British workforce have temporarily disappeared, either because they're ill or because they have retired early, the one thing we actually need in our economy is more young people actually in the country working. So economically, the economic case for more immigrants coming in is very strong. Public opinion is quite the other way. The government promised, successive governments promised, to get immigration down to below 80,000. Last year, from memory, it was 606,000, which is a slight missing of the target. Now, the whole of the publicity has been on the people who come by rubber boats, who are a small percentage of the immigration that's currently happening. Because so many of the temporary European migrants who came here to pick daffodils, to pick fruit, and do other seasonal jobs can no longer come, Lots of other people have been invited in from all over the place, which is why immigration has gone with the government's consent up to such a very high level. The area of huge controversy are the people who come across in rubber boats. And the argument is that we need to get to the evil people who are exploiting them. Let me examine that a little more carefully. Are there evil people exploiting them? Yes, there are. Why don't these 45,000 people who have come go through the official refugee organizations? Because they don't exist in many places, and it's almost impossible for them to get on it. How many of them are fleeing from some form of repression or a violently unhappy way of life? Quite a large number of them. I don't know how many, but quite a large number of them. They are taking the enormous risk of bringing themselves, their wives, their children, after having sacrificed perhaps everything they have to try and get away from where they were to a life that is somewhere better. And in many cases, those 45,000, in all the cases, those 45,000 have chosen this country. They're risking their lives to get here. They're some of the most miserable, dispossessed people in the world who come here with a hope in their hearts that we British, with our reputation over generations, would be prepared and willing to help them. And they're finding when they get here that they're getting a very frosty reception indeed. The way we can deal with this problem, not just a problem for us. Look at that great tragedy in the Mediterranean. Over 20,000 people have drowned in the Mediterranean in the last 10 years coming across from Africa. I don't know how many have drowned coming across the channel from France to us, but probably a significant number. Now, if every nation just operates in its own interest, we will not solve this problem. If we work cooperatively, we may be able to do so. Now, the European Union reached an arrangement that only affects European Union members just 10 days ago. They finally realized they had to get together. We are not part of that arrangement because we're not part of Europe. But we really should be looking with other nations to stop the outflow of people from the source, rather than try and catch them in the middle of the Mediterranean or in the middle of the Channel. And collectively, Europe and the UK would be able to do a great deal to ease life in their own countries, both through diplomacy and through the use of overseas aid, and prevent them coming here in the first place. But it is a matter that desperately needs the work and assistance and cooperation of other countries as well. And until such time as we have that, these miserable, dispossessed people are going to continue. Often some of the most put upon people anywhere you'll find in the world, they're going to continue to come along these dangerous routes, either across the Med to Greece and Italy, or across the Channel from France to here. And we need a cooperative effort if it's to be stopped.
Well, Sir John Major, on this stage, exactly this time last year, was your friend Chris Patten, Lord Patten, and he said two things which stuck in my mind. The first one was that he said that Lord Frost was to diplomacy what a chainsaw is to chiropody. And secondly, he said that of all the Conservative leaders he had served, and he served Ted Heath and Margaret Thatcher, and then Sir John Major, the most kind, the most reasonable, and by far the most intelligent was Sir John Major. Sir John Major, thank you very much indeed.
Thank you. Thank you very much. Thank you.